three more to go tomorrow for December. I'll call 03-1419 State v. Richard A. Brown, arguing on behalf of the defendant. Mr. Brown is attorney, assistant state public defender, Stephen P. Weiss. Mr. Weiss.
This case involves a trial court's denial. Oh, sorry, I thought you were waving to wait. Sorry. This case involves a trial court's denial of a petition for supervised release in a Chapter 980 case following a recommendation by the Department of Health and Family Services in favor of supervised release. The case raises two sets of issues. The dispositive issues in the case involve whether or not the state made its statutory burden of proof, and the standard to be used by the trial court in assessing that burden, and the appellate standard of review in that case. A second separate set of issues concerns the Court of Appeals' creation of a new hearsay exception in a published decision which would allow for the automatic admission in evidence of a written expert's report without any testimony by the expert. I'd like to address what I think are the dispositive issues first and then discuss the hearsay issues, which I think the court should decide in any event since there's a published decision now changing the rules. Now, as far as the standard of review goes, this is a statutorily allocated burden of proof and persuasion in Section 980.08, parentheses 4. That statute states that a court shall grant supervised release, quoting, unless the state proves by clear and convincing evidence, end of quoting, that it is still substantially probable that the individual will reoffend. In this case, the Court of Appeals ruled that a trial court acting under this statute was actually performing a discretionary decisional process rather than acting as a trier of fact with a specifically allocated burden of proof. The Court of Appeals further reviewed the trial court's decision in this case under the highly deferential misuse, or as we used to say, abuse of discretion standard of review. We submit that the statute is crystal clear in this case, that a court is not exercising any discretion in any way at a supervised release proceeding under the statute. The plain language mandates that a court shall grant release unless the state proves certain things by clear and convincing evidence. The court has no discretion. If the burden of proof is not met by the state, the court must grant the release. This isn't a situation where the court can weigh things. It cannot measure things. It cannot go with its gut instincts. Even the state
needs it. What is it measuring? What is the proof? What fact? You prove facts, right?
Yes.
What facts does it have to, is the burden?
Well, the statute specifically says that the court shall grant the petition unless the state proves by clear and convincing evidence that the person is A, still a sexually violent person, and B, that it is still substantially probable that the person will engage in acts of sexual violence if not continued in institutional care. Those are the two facts. And the state must prove those facts, or the court must grant the release. Now, below that, there's a series of circumstances that the court may consider in reaching its decision. And I would posit that that was a legislative determination as to what facts might be relevant for the state to present evidence on in assisting it in meeting its burden of proof if it's opposing the release. But the two facts are, number one, still sexually violent. Number two, still substantially probable. I should add, this case is under the original standard rather than the new reduced, relaxed standard.
What's the appellate standard of review here for that determination?
Our position is that the standard of review is the de novo standard of review as a question of law, as in every other question of whether or not a party has met its burden of proof in civil or criminal cases.
is that question, whether or not it has met its burden of proof, essentially a sufficiency of evidence question? In other words...
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Then why doesn't our opinion in Curiel control? Our opinion in Curiel, in a Chapter 980 proceeding, indicated what the proper standard of review was, and the question was, in part, you know, is it the same as criminal, as civil and criminal, and Justice Steinmetz wrote the opinion, and he said, well, we're going to do the criminal, and cited the, is it Pollinger? I forget what case it was, and set forth the language of what the review was from that case. A Pollinger, yes. And it is, an appellate court may not reverse a conviction, because he says it's the same, civil criminal. He said this 980, although the petitioner said it was like protective placement cases, we're going to say, Justice Steinmetz said, it's more like criminal for a variety of reasons, and then employed Pollinger. An appellate court may not reverse a conviction unless the evidence viewed most favorably to the state and the conviction is so insufficient in probative value and force that it can be said as a matter of law that no trier of fact acting reasonably could have found guilt beyond a reasonable doubt.
I don't dispute that that would be an appropriate phrasing of the standard. However, in this case, the Court of Appeals chose to use the misuse of discretion standard and did not grant what we would consider under Pollinger de novo review as a matter of law.
Counselor, if Dr. Kotkin's report had been properly admitted, and I know you dispute that, would the burden of proof have been met?
No.
Why not?
Because I think each person, each reviewing court, the appellate court, the trial judge, and all the parties all agreed that the Kotkin report was not significantly helpful to the state in meeting its burden. Now, the state in this court has argued both sides that, well, we can rely on the Kotkin report, but if we can't rely on it, its admission was harmless because it really didn't add anything much to our case anyway. As I'm sure the court's aware from the briefs and the parties.
But they're kind of stuck with that position, though. I mean, they kind of have to argue two sides to it. Good lawyers that you are. You are
a certainly didn't have to, but they chose to. But ultimately, the final paragraph of the Kotkin report, which is insolubly ambiguous, was that in the future he would support release and that the man was doing quite well. And then we have to remember that the Kotkin report was prepared in connection with a prior proceeding. He had interviewed Mr. Brown some, I believe, 9 months prior to the use of the report in this case. So who knows what that report would mean today. And I think Judge Franke himself, in his decision, said, well, it's not really much help to me because of the age. And likewise, the Court of Appeals acknowledged, well, it's not much help, really. Dr. Kotkin thought we needed a little more time for the newly invested Mr. Brown. So even with the Kotkin report, I think I would still be here on the sufficiency of the evidence issues, the standard of review issues, and the burden of proof issues regardless.
Okay. Thank you.
Not a particularly negative report as these things go, I can assure you. Turning to the actual proof or lack thereof in this case, it's our position that the state absolutely and completely failed to present any evidence whatsoever that Mr. Brown was much more likely than not to reoffend if granted supervised release under the terms recommended by the very department to which he was committed for treatment. The state presented one witness, and that witness was the expert of the Department of Health and Family Services, Dr. Warner. Dr. Warner testified unequivocally Mr. Brown had completed the entire core treatment program, testified that all the research that they had at their disposal said this program lowers the risk of recidivism, testified that under these circumstances, the department, the experts, were satisfied that he could be managed in the community. He indicated that there would be certain reasonable conditions of supervision, including, of course, a supervised living situation, drunk testing, alcohol restrictions and testing, testing for compliance with medication, and he even posited there could be electronic monitoring perhaps, or even polygraph testing to ensure compliance with the various rules, and that he should continue in whatever treatment programs the department and the supervising personnel felt were appropriate for him at that stage. But there is not a word in this record coming from the department other than in support of the supervised release under those conditions. And his report stated, it went so far in the report to actually state that it was the position of the department's placement specialists that there were appropriate placements in Milwaukee County and adequate services to supervise this man at that point in time. Now, once the state had presented that evidence, the defense did a bit of cross-examination to firm up that this was absolutely clearly the final word from the department. And that's the only evidence that was ever presented, save the Kotkin report. I think Justice Rosenczak anticipated where I would go next, so I'll spare the court that and indicate that the Kotkin report, even if it were to be admissible, would not change the ultimate evidence which was presented in this case. And this state brought in, there's nobody who said he was still dangerous. There's nobody who said he hadn't completed sufficient treatment. There's nobody who said we can't supervise him in the community. These are all the relevant considerations and ways that the state might have met its burden of proof. But in this case, the state chose to present only the evidence and the opinion from the experts at the department who said he's ready.
Doesn't the court have all the prior proceedings before it? Has its finding that this is a person under 980, and that at that time evidence was presented, and why can't it use that evidence?
That's a really complicated question, Justice Abrahamson.
The file
is before the court at that point in time. However, the judge who conducted the 980 trial in this case is not the judge who is hearing this proceeding. And there had been other proceedings in between the commitment, also not heard by this particular judge. This judge never stated on the record that he was considering or was even familiar with the evidence from the trial or any of the prior reports, save for the Kotkin report and the report that was before him. Had the state chosen to present evidence and ask this particular sitting judge in this particular branch to take judicial notice of the court files in this case number and the evidence presented at the prior trials, we might get into some very complicated issues there. But under the circumstances of this case, I don't think we even have to go there because there's no indication in the record, and Judge Frankie certainly never gave any indication that he was basing his decision on any of those things.
What did he base his decision on?
Well, to quote the Court of Appeals, which I would like to, the last sentence in their opinion is, quote, although the court struggled to articulate the exact basis on which it reached this apparently close call, we see nothing illogical in its assessment. And I would say that I can't tell you today what the judge based his decision on. I can tell you that the Court of Appeals apparently felt that he didn't come up with a very clear explanation for the basis of his decision. And I can tell you that if the Court of Appeals had to find that he struggled to articulate the basis of a decision in an apparently close case, the state certainly had not proven by clear and convincing evidence that this man was too dangerous to be released.
Well, the Court of Appeals said, logically, a court could infer that Brown remained a sexually violent person, and particularly given all the restrictions that Dr. Warner said would have to accompany his release, a court could also infer that Brown was still substantially probable to engage in acts of sexual violence if not continued in institutional care. Now, if we accept that, it seems to me that the state never has to introduce any evidence. Defendant introduces evidence that says, I want him out on, it's okay for supervised release, but, you know, needs a lot of conditions. And as soon as there are conditions, and of course if he's going to be released without conditions, there'll be a discharge. So as soon as you say that there are conditions, then a court could say, circuit court could say, I'm inferring they remain sexually violent. That's a presumption. That's the same thing, saying that. And then because of all these restrictions, I'm not convinced that he's not a problem. He's got problems, obviously. Otherwise, you wouldn't restrict him.
And I could see a circumstance.
You object to that, I gather. That
yes, I do. I think it's making a tremendous leap beyond the actual evidence. The evidence is that with these conditions, his risk is reduced to the point where he is not substantially likely to reoffend. And that was the only testimony before the court. Now, if the court said, well, if I'm going to release him, I'm going to release him with no conditions, and therefore he's going to be dangerous, I suppose we could get to the situation you were positing, Justice Abrahamson. But I'm sorry.
When he is released under supervised release, that doesn't mean that he's not a sexual offender under 980.
No, that's a lifetime commitment unless and until there's a discharge filed.
Does it mean that he's not substantially probable to engage in sexual violence?
Yes. That's the exact thing that the state must prove in order to deny the supervised release. So if he is released, there has been an implicit proof by the state, or a failure of proof, I should say, by the state, that he is no longer substantially probable to engage in sexual violence. That's the exact issue that the state carries the burden of proof on. They have to prove that he is. And our position would be that they have to present some scrap of evidence somewhere other than the fact of the underlying initial commitment to show that, particularly in a situation like Mr. Brown's case, where he completed all of the treatment that the experts had for him. They call their core program.
I've read the trial court's opinion several times. One of the things the trial court addresses is the use and the role of Zoloft. And the court says, as I recall, that it's a condition of the supervision to keep up with your meds, and the court says has some concerns with the role that'll play and whether or not that will keep him safe. Can't you argue? Okay, first of all, the only testimony here is that of Warner, or arguably the only live testimony, is that of Warner. One witness is called. But, of course, it's true, and you concede, that the trial court doesn't have to accept the testimony of an expert. And in the expert's report, there's some reference to use of Zoloft, and can't the trial court say, well, that use concerns me?
The judge certainly did say that, but what the judge said specifically was he wasn't certain about the use of Zoloft as an anti-androgenic, which is one of the referenced subjects at the bottom of the statute in question. And the doctor, when asked about that at the hearing by the judge, said, well, I'm a psychologist, I'm not a medical doctor, and I can't really give you any firm opinion one way or the other on the use of Zoloft. Now, certainly, and I wouldn't dispute this for a moment, if the state had brought in a psychiatrist or an expert in some fashion on anti-angiogenic drugs or antidepressant drugs, which Zoloft technically is, to discuss the pharmaceutical qualities of that drug, then the judge might have had an actual basis in the evidence for making some determination. But here all we have, I think I'm describing as just some musings.
Well, didn't the judge also say he had some concerns about the actuarial instruments used?
No, I believe the judge indicated that the actuarials were not particularly of use because the doctor once again testified that the actuarials would never change from the day you are first scored on. There's only one question in those actuarials that can ever change, and that is your age.
Well, what about the independent review doctrine then? You know, if in looking at, because I pulled out the two things I thought you could maybe arguably rely on in the trial court's opinion. I mean, he says that he looks at the track record 10 years ago. He says, and looks at the nature of the offense, that it's there were some of them that were violent. He seems to muse and say, and my common sense tells me that supervised release is really better for sexual offenses that occurred, that I groomed and premeditative rather than violent. And then he goes into this Zoloft thing that I've just discussed, and then mentions the actuarial tables. So if it's not in his opinion, what about independent appellate review doctrine? The state advances that. Can't we go someplace and look someplace else and find something?
Well, that's right, because a little, hey, under the NOFO standard of review and under the searching the record to uphold the discretionary act, I think the court is slightly differently limited, although both standards apply quite a bit of deference to the determination of the trial court. The problem here is that as this court or as the Court of Appeals would search this record, they would not find any evidence, you would not find any evidence in the record on any of the topics that you mentioned that militate against a supervised release. Every one of those factors in this case suggested that he was ready for the supervised release, including the fact that he had completed the court treatment program at the institution. Otherwise, we're in a situation where no one can ever be released.
Mr. Phillips, if I could shift gears just for a moment, because I see we're starting to run out of time there. Mr. Weiss, I'm sorry. I'm going to wait too long. You argue the right of cross-examination and confrontation, and I understand that there is a statutory right under Chapter 980, but you evolve that into a constitutional right, and I know you've argued Crawford v. Washington. How do you get to a constitutional right, given the fact that this is a civil proceeding?
I got there by way of this Court's writing in the Watson case, which was a 980 proceeding at the probable cause hearing. And in Watson, I've quoted from it in my brief, this Court said that a statutory right of cross-examination in various contexts can create a due process right of confrontation. I think that's an issue that's lurking in these cases. If this Court accepts the idea that expert reports should be admitted without requiring any testimony, it's certainly not one of the key issues, I think, at this point in this case. My orange light is on. I'd like to just address a couple of other points, unless the Court had more questions about the sufficiency issue.
Can you address whether or not this is really hearsay?
That's where I was headed. What really happened in this case is that the District 1 Court of Appeals is seeking to revisit an issue that it was rebuked by this Court on in the RS litigation. It's all cited and laid out in the briefs. But this case is so remarkably close to the original Court of Appeals decision in RS, which this Court reversed. In RS, it was a guardianship proceeding, but again, a mental status. It was a psychological examiner's report. It was prepared. It was, at various points in the Court of Appeals opinion, either provided, furnished, or filed with the Court, just as the report in this case. The Court of Appeals sought to distinguish, in RS, this case reversed the Court of Appeals by saying, well, no, it is hearsay, and everyone agrees it's hearsay. The only question is whether it falls under an exception. And in RS, this court said, well, it doesn't fall under this other statutory exception, which the Court of Appeals relied on in its RS decision. And this Court was very emphatic that if the legislature had intended to create a statutory hearsay exception for experts' reports, it would have said so. That's exactly what this Court said.
But, Counselor, isn't this different from RS in that RS, there wasn't a statute that said that the court-ordered report was to be filed? And here we have such a statute, and can't you tag that into the residual hearsay exception that the legislature said you have to file it, and they wouldn't have done that if they didn't think that it was going to become
you know, useful to the court in these determinations and therefore had the indicia of trustworthiness that we would require under that residual exception?
No, for several reasons, Justice. First, the language in the RS decision and the language in the statute and the language the Court of Appeals used, it's gotten very blurry. The word filed doesn't appear in any of the statutes, first of all. It says provided or furnished to the court. It doesn't say filed in this statute or in the 880 statute that was under consideration in RS. However, in both cases, the report was filed with the court. Now, the Court of Appeals, in its RS decision, at various points stated that 880 did require the report to be filed with the court. It said that at page 711. The Court of Appeals says, this is at 154 was second, the first RS, under section 880.33, the evaluative report prepared by the physician is filed with the court. And they say again, over on page 714, that the report must be provided to the court. As this court acknowledged, it was filed in RS. So I don't see that as being in any way determinative here, nor does the statute in this case require that the report be filed. It says provided. And there are many things filed with courts under statutory orders or under court orders or pretrial rulings that certainly no one would consider are automatically made evidence in the case.
Well, why is it different to say provided or filed? Why is that a difference that I should be concerned about?
To me, there's no difference. I thought that the Court of Appeals seemed to think, well, that made a big difference because it said filed, even though the statute really doesn't say filed. And then you would ask specifically, well, if it's filed, does that mean something?
Yes.
And I would say it doesn't mean anything.
Either way, it doesn't.
And furthermore, in none of these cases is there a statutory requirement for filing.
Why isn't it a record of regularly conducted activity under 6 or a health care provider record under 6M? Both are exceptions.
Because this report was specifically prepared for purposes of litigation in this particular proceeding. A regularly kept business record would be something perhaps a treatment record from the institution, maybe, and I'm not conceding that even for these purposes, but certainly when an expert is appointed for a particular piece of litigation to prepare a report, that's in no way a regularly conducted business activity. Dr. Hopkins does it once a week, you know, as part of his job, prepare and log in reports on Mr. Brown.
What about it's a health care provider record?
Again, Dr. Kotkin was not Mr. Brown's health care provider. He wasn't treating him. Mr. Brown had not gone to him for health care services or diagnoses. This was an expert who actually had been requested by Mr. Brown to evaluate him for a prior proceeding, which never came to court. So he just doesn't fall under any of those things. Does the court have anything else right now? It wants to run my lights on for a bit here.
Ms. Wellman.
Thank you. If it pleases the court, I am Sally Wellman, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state in this matter. I just want to make one clarification on Watson so that I don't forget to and it doesn't go unnoticed. I think that how Mr. Weiss referred to it a moment ago is not quite what the court said, and I'd ask the court to look at its 227 with second 167, paragraph 88. And this court did not say that a constitutional right of confrontation applies at a probable cause hearing. It said the rules of evidence apply to a probable cause hearing. It cited to 980.032, which says at any hearing there's a right to present and cross-examine witnesses. And then it said, in some circumstances, this right becomes a constitutional right to confront witnesses. And it cited 980.051M. That is the provision that says at trial the person shall have the rights that a criminal defendant, constitutional rights that a criminal defendant would have at trial. And in Lombard, this court recently held, clarified that that provision applies only at trial. So 98005 just doesn't apply. And what we're looking at is 98003 sub 2, which is present and cross-examine witnesses. And it's our position that that means you can present witnesses or other evidence, I assume. I mean, it says witnesses, but I can't imagine that the state would argue that a sex predator could not present documentary evidence to the court. And you can cross-examine whatever witnesses do testify that the state calls. But it isn't a requirement that the state must present a specific witness at the hearing.
Could defendant here have subpoenaed the doctor to testify?
Yes.
He's an expert witness. What about the old case?
I'm sorry, what about the old case? Is what? That it?
ALT. It was a medical malpractice case that can be but need not be interpreted to limit the right to call people who are expert witnesses but are not called by the party who got the testimony in the first place.
I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with that case, and I don't know what that ruling is based on, so I don't know if it would apply here or not.
Maybe reading it would help, maybe not.
Maybe not, but...
What about the... Let's try another case. This is
okay.
20, this is 20 questions.
Okay? You're on number two.
And that is the Teresa B. case.
Yes, that one I have read.
I would hope. And that one, in part, deals with the procedural due process argument based on a statute that sets up a procedure. And the court in footnote number 3, I'm going to read it, says, we reject the county's suggestion that Teresa should have deposed or subpoenaed the professionals who had previously examined her if she wanted to contest their findings. It is the county that bears the burden of proof, citing the RS case. As we explained, due process requires the county to produce one or more licensed professionals to testify in person as to their independent opinions. The county does not meet its burden of proof by presenting an expert who serves us nothing more. And this was whether or not the issue, as you recall, in part was whether they were a conduit. But boy, there's language in that opinion, I think, that at least could be used to support an argument that there is a sense of procedure has been set forth that Teresa shouldn't have been required to subpoena, which is the argument that you've made here. He could have subpoenaed or called that witness, and that the due process implications are set forth because of the procedure set forth in the statute.
Well, I have a couple of responses to that. One is I think that argument would carry a great deal more weight if the state had not called Dr. Warner, had not called any doctors, because in this context, Dr. Warner was the examining expert in the sense that he was the one who had done the 98007 reevaluation report. And Teresa B., there was not something comparable. There was not like a Dr. Warner and a Dr. Kotkin situation. If Teresa B. were to be read to extend that far, I think it would mean that every expert who had ever examined the sex predator and done an annual evaluation or a supervised release evaluation, that the court cannot look at any of that and consider it at a supervised release hearing without that person coming in to testify. And I just think that's reading way too much into Teresa B. I also think Teresa B., the statute at issue there was the guardianship statute 880.33. And that statute had already been held. The language is a little different if we're looking at the language because it says the guardian's attorney or guardian ad litem, the ward's attorney, has the right to present and cross-examine witnesses, including the examining physician. And our statute does not contain that language. And that had already been held in RS, I believe, or one of the prior cases, to mean the state must call that examining physician. So all of those are factors that limit Teresa B. I also think Teresa B. is more about substantive ability to meet the burden of proof. I mean, they talk about procedural due process, but what they're really saying is, state, you can't meet your burden of proof with this witness because he doesn't know what he needs to know to testify.
Let me tell you what concerns me with one of your arguments so you can address it, and that is the implication of the Court of Appeals decision and your part of your argument with regard to Chapter 51 proceedings. Chapter 51 proceedings, of course, are the mental commitment hearings. And this, unlike the distinction that the Court of Appeals makes with regard to RS dealing with 880, you know, 33 like you do, where the statute under 51 is the same kind of the court shall language that we have here. So that distinction between 880 in this case may exist, but it doesn't exist with regard to Chapter 51. And the circuit court judge, prior circuit court judges here, for those who had mental health commitment jurisdiction, caseload, know that we would appoint, as in Chapter 51 requires, after probable cause was found, that we would appoint a psychiatrist or a psychologist or a medical doctor. In Marathon County, we usually appointed, we chose from the list of the statutory options, a medical doctor who was acquainted with these issues and a psychologist. But then we would have the final hearing. Every once in a while we'd have a jury trial. Usually it'd be a trial to the court. But we would always have to accommodate the doctor's availability for testimony. And sometimes those were huge hurdles because these people are busy and we would do it by phone. But with your argument and the Court of Appeals rationale, it would seem that that's all for naught because the statute... No, because you don't need to have them testify live. Their reports will be sufficient.
Well, I guess in this case, I don't know that the Court of Appeals is necessarily saying that the report of the examining physician under who had, you know, for example, that Dr. Warner would not have had to testify. I think they just don't address that. And in Chapter 51, as I understand it, what you're describing, it would be the equivalent of the first, the trial in the 980. It's the first commitment. There's not a comparable procedure, I don't think, for supervised release. Each year the state has to recommit, if I recall Chapter 51 correctly.
The issue I'm focusing on is the admissibility of that written report and whether that's admissible. And if it's admissible, then I could have, as a 51 judge, I could have two reports and no live testimony. What's the problem with that? Either it's admissible or it isn't admissible.
Right, and I think it is admissible and the court can consider it in the kind of case we have here, and to some extent 51 may be comparable, although it's, you know, it's a little different in its operation.
It's different in its operation, but what I see as the Court of Appeals distinguishing language in some of your arguments, it isn't different in terms of the statute. These reports are required. The court shall appoint. You know.
Right, and those are court experts, correct? Because I think that is the difference between RS. It was not a court expert. It was a party expert.
The court shall appoint two expert witnesses, and they can be a psychiatrist, or they can be a medical doctor with expertise in mental health, and they can be a psychologist. I mean, they're specified what pool from which you can appoint the two experts who shall, you know, then provide reports to the court just like this statute.
Well, I certainly don't see a due process problem with this. I mean, I think that, frankly, I don't know of any sex predator case where the state has not presented the examining physician, and they did so here. So I don't know as a practical matter how often it would be likely to happen, but it could under your scenario. But as a due process issue, as long as the parties know that the court can look at the entire file and the previous reavows and can call any of the authors of those reports they want and question them, then I don't see why that process, we can say, well, that process itself is more likely to lead to an erroneous decision, which
maybe,
is the bottom line.
You know, maybe we've been, and I looked at the bench book last night on Chapter 51, and it is in accord with my recollection and my practice. But maybe that practice wasn't necessary. Maybe we didn't have to go through all of those hoops, and maybe we can just have Chapter 51 commitments based on the reports.
Well, it seems to me very likely that in those situations the defense might well call that witness.
Well, then you get into Alt versus Klein.
Well, yes, and I apologize. Certainly happy to look at it and try to answer the court's questions on that. But it seems to, well, frankly, as a matter of due process, I don't know that there's any authority that says the state has to have a judicial decision at all for the supervised release end of it, although that's the way Wisconsin has chosen to do it. And
how is it chosen to do it, in practice or by statute?
By statute, to have a supervised release hearing, have a judge make the decision. You could, I think, by constitutionally, you probably could have it be a non-judicial decision reviewable by a judge.
We didn't.
That's going a little far.
So now we got a judge, right? We got a hearing. We don't call it a trial, but we call it a hearing. Are the rules of evidence applicable to this hearing?
I did know in my brief, based on the case law that's comparable in terms of Higginbotham, I think, which is the prior Old Sex Crimes Act, which had a comparable kind of, you get committed and then there's discharges or conditional releases. The parole revocation type of cases that all said no on these, not the initial placement or commitment or finding, you don't have to. Defense counsel pointed out in his reply brief, I think that, is it 90111? I'm not good with numbers. 90111, 90101, one of those, that says that the rules of evidence apply to all hearings except, and the 980 supervised release hearings are not accepted out, they're not written out. Neither are probation, parole revocation, and conditional release revocation in 971 insanity cases, and yet the court has held the rules don't apply. Now, so I don't know. I guess the short answer is I'm not sure, because the court just didn't deal with that statute in those prior cases.
I ask you, assuming they do apply, under what? Is this hearsay?
Yes, it's hearsay.
Okay. Is it admissible under an exception?
We argue that it's admissible under the residual exception and the regularly conducted. I'm drawing a blank on the rest of that phrase.
Business, right.
I think the best argument, frankly, is the common law judicial notice cases that we rely on first and foremost. And, you know, maybe even judicial notice is sort of a label that maybe we don't, I mean, it doesn't quite.
What are you taking judicial notice of?
You're taking judicial notice of the prior reports filed in this case on the same issue.
You're taking judicial notice of the file.
Right, in essence. Because, I mean, remember, these cases are ones where the person is committed. There is no specific time that it ends. It's not like a 51 where it ends in 1 year. They get annual reevaluations. At that point, they may move for supervised release. They may automatically get a discharge hearing if they don't waive that hearing. There may or may not be additional examinations at that point. At other points along the timeline, regardless of the reevaluation, the predator can petition for supervised release and the court automatically gets a report. And that's what happened in this case. Just a few months before this, he had moved for supervised release, Mr. Brown had. The court appointed Mr. Kotkin to do a court report as a court expert. He filed his, well, he didn't actually file his report. He thought he was a defense expert. So he sent it only to defense counsel. It didn't recommend supervised release. Defense counsel withdrew the petition, and what he really should have done was filed it with the court. So once that got straightened out, he did file it with the court. And you may have many, many prior reports in these cases, and they're all relevant, even the older ones, because what you're looking at, in essence, is what has changed, what has gotten better, what is different about this man now that we can say he's still substantially likely to engage in acts of sexual violence, because if he isn't, then he's out of here, he's got total discharge. But he's not substantially likely to the extent that we have to keep him in institutional confinement. So when you're looking at that kind of a question about current current status, you have to. It's just logical to me that you have to look at the past, the present, our best guess as to prediction forward. And these reports are intended to guide the court. Why the court can't look at it.
I understand that, but you need a rule or you need something. You know, when I see the trial court seems to be relying in part on his common sense that supervised release should be for those offenses which are groomed and premeditated. You know, I think, you know, that makes me nervous because, so what are you relying on? It doesn't really fall within judicial notice under the statute, right?
Not under the statute. We're not relying on the statute.
So your best argument on admissibility is not then judicial notice under the statute, is not the regular records exception, is not sub 24 residual hearsay, but a common law.
Well, some of the case law that we rely on, sign our brief, calls it judicial notice. They're clearly not referring to the statute. In fact, some of them predate the statute. Mm-hmm. This is most comparable to me, it seems to be, to State versus Cook, which we talked about in our brief. It's at 66 with second. It was an insanity commitment. The person moved for conditional release, which is what supervised release term used in the insanity law, and the court looked at the expert's opinion when the guy had been committed, who said he has this mental disorder and he's very dangerous or whatever he said, and now the expert was saying he either doesn't have the disorder or he's not dangerous. The court could look at that. The man didn't come in and testify to that.
In this case, I just wanted to clarify. Sure. You're talking about judicial notice, but in this case, Judge Franke did not take judicial notice, correct?
He didn't use that term.
And as I recall, this report was a report that had been ordered for a prior hearing. In other words, it wasn't ordered for this hearing.
Correct.
It was ordered for a hearing a while ago.
Correct.
So
a few months ago.
None of those a few months ago, but it wasn't for this hearing.
Right, right.
So the inference that, because I don't think it fits under, I don't want business records, but I certainly think that he could take judicial notice, but he didn't do it.
Well, but he didn't use that term. But many of the cases that I cite in our brief, the courts did not say, I'm taking judicial notice of this prior financial statement or this prior expert report. But the court said that's what they were doing, and it was okay that they did it, even though they didn't call it that. And certainly in this case, it seems to me that where, and everyone knew, I mean, the whole question was whether the court was going to look at that or not, and he told the parties he was. Either one was free to call him, Kotkin as a witness. Now, you might certainly, we would agree, there would be a different issue and a much bigger problem if there were reports filed with the court that the parties had no notice of the contents of, and no notice that the court was going to look at
them. If I could, it really begs the question to say that either party can call Dr. Kotkin if the burden is on the state.
Right.
So it's the state that has to produce evidence to show that there is that this individual is not subject to the release provisions of the chapter, right?
Right.
So wouldn't it behoove the state to call any witnesses to support that claim?
Well, it did call Dr. Warner, the most recent examining physician.
And he was supporting release, was he not?
Right, he was. And I'm glad we got to this point before we ran out of time, because I think it's critical that the court understand that our position is that the state did present evidence. It didn't present an expert opinion in support of its ultimate position, but it presented evidence. It presented both Dr. Warner's report, which was admitted into evidence, and his testimony.
But what was the evidence, if I could, that supported continued confinement?
The evidence, well, there was a lot of it, but to summarize, and it's in our brief, the evidence was, one, the nature of the prior offenses, which had started when he was very, very young, and had been multiple, had involved family, had also, the most recent one, had involved someone that was not family, a runaway girl that he had only known for a very short time, which is significant because it's a more impulsive act and therefore maybe harder for him, if you're on supervised release,
so
to intervene.
So we had the nature of the prior offenses.
We had the fact that he committed the most recent one after he had already had a great deal of intervention and treatment. He'd been in, I don't know how you pronounce it, Hami home, I think, for adolescents. So that was of concern to the court. The expert in this case, Dr. Warner, had talked about the fact that Mr. Brown was voluntarily taking Zoloft and that it was helping to reduce his sexual fantasies and masturbation and sexual preoccupation, and the expert thought that he should continue to do that on supervised release. But that was a problem because it was voluntary and he could just stop if he wanted to. And I think that is legitimate for the court to look at, because if he just stops if he wants to when he's still in the institution, of course the risk is lower.
So if I understand your position, if this is the evidence upon which the court relied, then this individual would never be subject to supervised release.
No, that's not. I don't believe that's correct, because the court also looked at treatment. The fact that, yeah, he had finished the core program. That's the first program. He then went on to the second program, which the expert says agreed with the question, yeah, that's the one where we really make sure that you've internalized everything that you've learned in treatment, that you're really getting it and can apply it. He had not completed that program. At least there was no evidence he'd completed all the blocks of that program. And the treatment staff at the institution said there is more treatment that would be helpful to him here. He hasn't maxed out. He hasn't done everything we have to offer him. Now, it may be, I do want to make sure that I'm not being unclear in my answer, however, there may well be some individuals who will never get out and shouldn't, because they will never get to that point. But we don't know if Mr. Brown is or not.
But if the doctor who's testifying on behalf of the state and applying all these standards is saying that based upon my best opinion, this gentleman is subject to the release provisions, what is the hat that Judge Frankie hangs on to support his ruling?
He's drawing different inferences from the facts that expert is supplying than the expert is drawing. The expert is saying, well, he's completed some of the treatment, and there's research out there that says, whatever they call this treatment, behavioral cognitive stuff helps to reduce recidivism. It's not specific to this particular program, however, and the studies doesn't say that it may or may not vary with more rather than less treatment. It seems to me legitimate for the court to say, well, other people, his staff, his treatment, actual providers are saying there's more treatment that would benefit him, more he could get out of treatment. Let's wait and see. He can get it. He'll get another re-eval in a year, and he can move for another supervised release hearing in a certain period of time. So this is not a forever decision. This is at this moment in time. Let's see some more from him.
There was nothing in these reports that said anything else than this person could get out on supervised release, as I understand it. I may have over, but that, in other words, by clear, you have to prove this by clear and convincing evidence.
Right.
I don't want to, it just seemed to me that Judge Frankie was saying, well, he did all these things in the past, and this is his treatment, and both Dr. Warner and Konkin said, well, Konkin said he's on track, and you're saying, well, that isn't enough, that a year from now he can come up or whenever, and there would be possibly an opportunity for him to get out. I think what Justice Butler is indicating, what does it take? What does it take for a person to get out on supervised release?
Well, I guess, you know, I don't think there's any concrete answer I can give to that, but I think the fact that there is more treatment that he hasn't completed, another factor that I think is significant here is the situation. I mean, this was a pedophile who had abused his sisters at home for a long time, at least one of whom was retarded. And that woman now lived with his parents, and her retarded child lived with them. And, of course, the expert was saying, well, he shouldn't have any unsupervised contact with the family. But he also said in his report, and I think this is significant, that he'd recently had a phone conversation with his sister victim, his prior victim, in which she offered, when he gets out, to help him get dates. And he declined that offer, and the expert saw that as a good thing, that he declined the offer. Well, I agree, that's a good thing. But I think the court was also allowed to fairly infer that if he was having that conversation with her at all, then perhaps he wasn't very far along in understanding victimization and what he had really done. Now, we don't know all of the underlying circumstances of the phone call, but I think that the court was entitled to give that some weight and to consider whether he, in fact, does not need more out of treatment than he's progressed to.
If I could, I guess what's concerning me, and I think you've heard this question from some of the other members of the court, it almost sounds as though the position of the trial court and the position taken by the state is that Mr. Brown would have to come in and show that he was ready for release.
No, I don't agree with that. The state absolutely had the burden of proof by clear and convincing evidence. All we're saying is that you don't have to have a bottom-line expert opinion to meet that if the evidence, testimony, facts presented by the expert lead to reasonable inferences that a fact finder could draw that would say, no, he still is too substantially likely to reoffend unless he's kept in institutional care. In our brief, we talk about the Wenk case. And that, again, is a conditional release in insanity. But the state had the burden of proof by clear and convincing evidence to prove that he was still too dangerous to be conditionally released. I think three experts testified in that case, and all of them recommended conditional release. The circuit court denied conditional release, and that was upheld by the Court of Appeals. So it's, when you say we didn't present any evidence, we didn't present an expert opinion that he was ready for supervised release, but we certainly presented evidence. And I don't know if you wanted me to try and get to the standard of review briefly.
Before you do that, sure. I have a question. What if the testimony here was exactly, in my hypothetical, as existed here? The only difference is the state didn't call Dr. Warner. Rather, the respondent, Brown's counsel, called Dr. Warner. Everything else was said verbatim. Would it be your position that this record upholds a determination that the state has met its burden by clear and convincing evidence?
Yes, because as long as his testimony was the same and the same inferences could be drawn from it.
Even though the state didn't call a single witness and offer any evidence at all.
Right. Now, procedurally, it's hard for me to kind of picture how that would exactly come about. But,
they just present the entire file and say, Judge, look at the entire file. You can take judicial notice of it, see all these past things. We rest our case.
I suppose they could. I don't know of anything either in the statute or certainly in the Constitution that would prohibit that. Because the burden of proof is met by what the evidence can show and the inference you draw from it, not just who put it in.
And this, your position would be the state has met its burden of proof even if it didn't accept Dr. Kay's report.
Oh, right, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Because, in fact, in our brief when we talk about the sufficient evidence, we don't rely on his report at all because we don't need to.
Okay. Let's get on to what the standard of review is.
Frankly, the state doesn't care which you do. We really don't, because we think that, I think an argument can be made both ways. What is important, though, is that the current law says that it's erroneous exercise of discretion. That's Seibert, which is cited in our brief, and then Wenk, which is a comparable insanity condition of release case. So if you were to change it now to a sufficiency of the evidence test, you would have to overrule those cases. And that's, obviously something that this court doesn't do lightly. I always liked abuse of discretion because it's easier to say. Erroneous exercise is kind of long, but erroneous exercise of discretion, it still has the factual component. In neither situation, when the counsel talks about de novo, and that doesn't mean the court comes in and looks at the record and makes its own inferences different from those that support the verdict or the decision. You still have to defer any credibility determinations by the court, any reasonable inferences that would support the verdict. Really the only difference, I think, is that the exercise of discretion standard takes more cognizance of the fact that even though there's a burden of proof on the state by clear and convincing evidence, the ultimate decision is so predictive and evaluative. It's everyone's best attempt to give a person limited freedom outside the institution and yet protect the public by predicting if we have these safeguards in place, is it still substantially likely that he would he'll reoffend if we don't keep him locked up? And the nature of the factors that the statute outlines, you know, in terms of nature and circumstances of prior offenses, the effects of treatment, things like that, are almost inherently judgment and weight and evaluative based. So I think that's why it seems natural to think of it as abuse of discretion standard. We can't say it would be wrong to use a sufficiency of evidence standard. And there again, I think Pollinger is taking out the fact that now the burden of proof is clear and convincing evidence. My understanding of civil law is that it's essentially the same in that you look to see looking at everything in the light of the finding of the verdict, is there any credible evidence, or you can only reverse if there's no credible evidence to support it. So I think it's the comparable ways of looking at sufficiency. And, you know, obviously we think in this case we win under either one.
Chief, if I may, you know, under the erroneous exercise of, I've had a hard time dealing with what the standard of review in this case. And under the erroneous exercise of discretion, now there still is a component of de novo review, if you will, because it's whether or not the court misapplied the facts or law. Well, in order to determine whether or not you misapplied the law, you know, there's a de novo review, I think. But I'm not sure. I cited Curiel and yet, I'm not sure which one it is. Is it erroneous exercise, which has a de novo component to it, or is it sufficiency of evidence? And what difference does it make?
Well, you know, I'm not sure either. And I did try to, you know, to some extent, try to kind of play out, well, if we use this language of this standard or this one, what really would make the difference? And in this case, I didn't see that. Just to muddy the waters a little more, in case they're not muddy enough, there are some other civil commitment, mental commitment, or guardianship cases. I think Mr. Weiss cited Joseph P. or Cheryl F. or something, where they usually have a slightly different standard that says, well, we're bound by the facts, but then it's a legal question whether the facts meet the standard. And again, those are kinds of things where the government or the person wanting to put the person in some kind of custody or reduce their rights of guardianship by guardianship has the burden to prove they meet the standard. They're incompetent or they're incapable of taking care of themselves or whatever it might be. I mean, if I as a lawyer, an appellate lawyer in particular, would be saying maybe it doesn't make any difference because in many situations standard of review isn't the whole ball game. But in this situation, maybe it doesn't.
I mean, I hear your opposing counsel indicate at least initially erroneous exercise of discretion or abuse of discretion. I mean, are you both in accord? You said at the outset that the current law says abuse of discretion is the standard of review.
I think he agrees that's what the law says but thinks that it's wrong, if I may be so bold as to state your position.
Find out. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Oh, I'm glad. I mean, sorry.
Awesome.
If this decision were to be reversed, does that automatically mean that we would order supervised release?
Ooh, I think it depends on the ground. If you reverse on the ground that the court considered Dr. Kotkin's opinion wrongly or denied us some kind of a statutory or constitutional right, then I think all that would happen would he would get a new hearing. If you reverse on sufficiency of the evidence, then I guess the effect would be to grant supervised release, and then it would go back into a posture where the DHFS, the Department of Health and Family Services, comes up with a specific plan that the court then still has to okay for him to, you know, to actually implement that. I think is how it works.
What county was this?
Milwaukee.
Not to worry.
And on that note, I will take my seat unless there are further questions.
Thank you, Ms. Wellman. Mr. Weiss.
Thank you.
Thank you, judges. I guess I'll work backwards a little bit. I have a lot of things I'd like to say in a really short amount of time, and I realize it's late today. The Seibert case, which the state suggests sets the law of the standard of review, I think does not do that. First of all, I don't think you have to overrule it. It could certainly use clarification. It's a court of appeals case. And in Seibert, the court of appeals said, and it's at headnote 1 at page 314 of 220 was second. It's cited in the briefs. Discussing the original standard of review for the original placement back when trial courts were given an option of institutional commitment or community supervision at the outset, there was a discretionary decision to be made at the dispositional hearing. The Court of Appeals said that the determination of placement is a discretionary act, and then from there they went on to discuss supervised release. I think Seibert is really not on point specifically. It's dicta at best, and I think that the court could simply clarify it. And that whole discretionary notion arose under the prior statute, which of course no longer exists. I think that this case is so akin to the RS case that I don't want to belabor the hearsay points, other than to point out that this court itself stated at the end of its RS decision, at page 210, that we do not believe that in a contested guardianship proceeding, a petitioner could carry the burden of proof without in-person testimony from the examining psychologist. And I think that should certainly apply equally to the use of the Kotkin report here in this contested proceeding where the state clearly had the burden of proof. That said, and Justice Abrahamson indicated just as Assistant Attorney General Wellman was finishing up, that this was a Milwaukee case, and of course indicated that that meant there was no problem with the supervised release. I think it's really impossible to view the decision in this case and the somewhat difficult record and the Court of Appeals' explanation of how the judge had a tough time articulating his real reasoning in this close case. I think there's a subtext here. I think that we need, you know, to just lay it on the table. There's another case that's pending before this court now on a petition for review that I filed, State versus Allison, which is 03-2496. That's from Judge Sankovitz, and factually it's almost identical to this case. There was one witness, the doctor from the department, who unequivocally recommended supervised release. And again, there's a vague record and some hemming and hawing, no other witnesses. But lo and behold, supervised release was denied for somewhat inarticulable reasons again. I've asked that that case be joined for decision with this case. That's all on file. I won't go into any further on that particular matter. But I don't think that we can just simply put the Schulteus matter and the whole situation with supervised release in Milwaukee out of our minds, because I think what's actually happening in many of these cases where the department is actually recommending release, where the experts are saying that people are ready for release, I think the judges now feel increasing pressure to simply deny the release and live and die on the appeal of the denial, rather than to put themselves and the county and these individuals into what I'll just call the Schulteus morass, because there's really no other word for it at this point. And if these judges were to strictly enforce the state's burden of proof on these records, where the only people testifying are the experts from the department, and those very experts are the people that this court in Morford said were trusted and designated by the legislature to make these decisions in a dispassionate method based on the science and their knowledge rather than on the local politics and pressure. And that was exactly what this court said about those experts in Morford.
Do you agree that trial court can reach its decision without expert witness?
I would say that under some circumstances, that's certainly probably true. I wouldn't say that across the board. One doesn't know exactly what evidence. Yes, I would certainly agree with that.
And you, I'm sure, would agree that the evidence upon which the trial court makes a decision doesn't have to be brought forth by the state, even if it has the burden of proof. You look at the whole thing at the end of all the evidence, right?
It would depend. In other words, if the defense said, well, is there any, you know, if the court called the case and said, is there any evidence, and the state said, we have no evidence, to present. I don't know that they could carry their burden.
No, but that's right. But once the state puts in something or the defendant goes ahead and puts in something, the court looks at the entire
record. Oh, yes, yes. I misunderstood. Yeah.
Right. Sorry. And so why can't the trial court here say, we've heard the doctor, we ignore everything else, but just on the offense and just on what the doctor says and just on all of these conditions, which are going to be very hard to enforce outside, I'm just not persuaded that supervised release is okay. And I am persuaded that to the two factors that you say he's still violent and that there's a substantial probability he'll reoffend. Court can do that, can't it?
A court could do that if there were specific evidence that would support that finding, yes.
I don't think there is here.
There's clearly not here. The conditions in this case were so reasonable. Take your medicine as a condition of your release, which, of course, is enforceable. It's not purely voluntary. If they tell you a condition of your release is you show up in my office and you take a pill every day, you don't show up, you get revoked. Having a supervision, having a placement, having monitoring, these are routine. These would be routine for a parolee from a sex crime who wasn't found to be a 980 person, these conditions. There's just no evidence in this case that this man was unsupervisable, and there's no evidence that with adequate supervision, he was still dangerous.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Weiss. Thank you, Ms. Wellman, for yet another Chapter 980 supervised release case. Time's out, unless Mr. Weiss doesn't object. All right. That ends the hearing in 03-14-19, State versus Richard A. Brown. We are in recess until 9:45 tomorrow. Okay.